patient. As a sergeant in boot camp, your child will not feel safe. You can't disarm your child's fear by bullying, insulting, shaming, or shouting at her. Forget the authoritarian, spare the rod, spoil the child stuff, and dismiss the urge to be unyieldingly strict, demanding, cold, or punitive. Instead, be authoritative, leading your child calmly, firmly, and kindly. It is okay to compromise with your child occasionally, as long as it's clear who is in control. Are you confident? Part of being an effective leader with your child is giving clear instructions and asking simple questions. Asking too many open-ended questions such as, "What do you want to do now?" to an at-risk child can signal a lack of confidence on your part. A child feels safer when the adult is in charge. Such broad questions unnerve a child who is not equipped to answer effectively because of delayed language or reasoning skills. Instead of, "Do you want to have a bath soon?" say, "In 10 minutes, it will be time for your bath." Instead of, "What do you feel like having for lunch today?" give simple choices. "Would you like an apple or a banana with your chicken soup for lunch today?" See Chapter 6 for tips on handling discipline and staying in charge. We've had Curtis since he was 18 months old. He's my grandson, and we have legal custody. At about 3 months old, he was nearly drowned a couple of times. It was forcefully done to him by his mother while my son was in the military. Now, at age 8, Curtis still has a real fear of dying. He talks about it. He thinks about it. He worries a lot and is anxious about things. When he first came to us, he wasn't sleeping and was having nightmares. He would always want to climb in our bed. It was like sleeping with a helicopter. He'd twist and turn quite a bit. He still protects himself. He's always on guard. He's a control freak. That's how he gets through things. At the Hope Connection Camp, Curtis felt safe. That was the biggest thing. He knew nobody was going to hurt him or force him to do anything he didn't want to do or yell at him or hit him. And learning to communicate better about what he needs and wants was huge. That whole program has done him a world of good. He's doing much better now, as far as being able to really interact with people and create and maintain relationships. He participates in everything he possibly can. Curtis has managed to stay on the honor roll, and I credit Dr. Purvis. A few years ago, he couldn't have done that. Guardian of a child removed from an alcohol and drug-abusing mother. Prevent sensory overload. Intense sights, sounds, and bodily sensations may bewilder and frighten your at-risk child whose senses haven't developed fully. You might be surprised at the little things that distress your child. Someone wearing perfume, the unfamiliar texture of clothing, or jostles in the schoolyard. You can help reduce sensory overload and the panic it stirs. The first step is to reduce visual clutter. Choose simple and subdued decorations for your home, and particularly for rooms your child uses regularly. Avoid busy patterns or sharply contrasting colors. Keep a few toys available, but don't surround your child with a storeful. Minimize brightly colored and loud videos or games. It also helps to lower the volume on your voice and electronics. Speak quietly and lower the music or television volume a few notches. Be mindful to remove extra odors, including air fresheners, colognes, aftershave, scented candles, and perfumed deodorants that are distracting and irritating to a child with sensory processing issues. Be cautious about such places as restaurants, activity centers, and amusement parks. These are full of raucous sounds, frenzied visual activity, unexpected physical jostling, and unfamiliar odors that can easily overstimulate your child. Limit exposure to these settings while your youngster is still catching up developmentally. If your child has auditory sensitivities, a great idea is to keep soft earplugs handy for specific times when he encounters too intense sounds. To empower your child further, allow him to keep the earplugs in his pocket for emergency use. Having a coping mechanism will be extremely soothing to your child, but don't let him wear the earplugs continuously throughout each day. Too much usage will impair hearing and language development. Here's an example of sensory overload. Not long after Wynn came home from the orphanage, he began ripping wallpaper off the bathroom wall. His mother was more concerned about her little boy's welfare than her home decor, so instead of going ballistic, she tried to figure out what was driving such peculiar and destructive behavior. She thumbed through the behavioral journal she had been keeping for her son and noticed that this little boy always acted oddly when he was in an environment of bright, contrasting colors and visual clutter. She knew that during the first 2 years of his life, Wynn lived in a sterile and austere institutional setting. His mom realized that the wallpaper's busy, colorful pattern was probably unnerving and threatening to him. Ripping it was a self-protective response against the foreign colors and dramatic pattern that gave too much visual stimulation to his little eyes. Armed with this insight, his mom was able to take proactive measures to minimize his visual overload and gradually help him learn to tolerate it better. Don't corner them. Clearly, if you are trying to increase felt safety, never put a traumatized child in a position where he feels cornered and physically threatened. However, you also need to be mindful that sometimes even well-intentioned gestures can feel unsafe to a harmed child. A youngster who was hit or hurt by caretakers in the past can misinterpret a playful or friendly gesture as threatening. Even just casually tousling the hair of a child with sensory processing disorder can send him into a fit. Certain gestures are more likely to be misconstrued by former victims of abuse. For example, an adult placing two hands on either side of a young girl's face or shoulders in a kind gesture of affection can be deeply unsettling to a former sexual abuse victim who remembers being locked in close proximity to an adult with no safe escape route. If a young girl was ever pinned down and forcibly assaulted in the past, such a simple gesture, intended in this case to be safe and affectionate, can trigger flashbacks and a behavioral meltdown. So it's always important to be mindful and respectful of physical boundaries. When in doubt, use just one hand at a time to touch the child so she or he doesn't feel trapped. Also, be wary of giving unexpected touch. The biochemical cascade of fear. Important body and brain functions are controlled by substances called neurotransmitters. These work on the cellular level, much like a set of interrelated chemical switches and control functions, such as blood pressure, mental alertness, and body temperature. The right amount and ratio of neurotransmitters allows optimum functioning, but when they're out of balance, they set the stage for behavioral dysfunction. When a child becomes frightened, her neurotransmitter switches respond in one of two possible ways. One way is to become extra alert and aroused, which would enable the fight-or-flight response. A child experiencing extreme fright through this neurochemical route will likely display externally obvious behavior, such as hitting, kicking, yelling, or running away. In the alternative fear reaction, the child goes numb and dissociates in order to mentally escape from the threatening situation. A child on this neurochemical path turns her fear response inward, shutting off the outside world, hiding, and getting lost inside herself. She is apt to physically hide or bury herself in activities with inanimate objects. As fear escalates, it triggers a series of biochemical events in the body that reduce a child's ability to behave calmly and think clearly. The progression moves from calm to vigilant to alarm to fear to terror. By the time that fear kicks in, it is immediate and survival-oriented and supersedes all other mental processing. Vulnerable, at-risk children can have neurotransmitter systems that remain hyper-aroused, making them less resilient to stress over time. The more anxious this child feels, the more she reactivates old traumas, which in turn releases neurotransmitters that make her increasingly aggressive and belligerent and unreasonable. For some children, chronic heightened reaction to stress can cause a condition called pain agnosia, the inability to feel pain. This same hyperreactivity blocks learning and is one reason why a kindergartner might know her alphabet today, but can't get past the letter D tomorrow. Fortunately, over time we can scale back this biochemical reactivity by dramatically reducing fear and teaching children new coping skills. Help children identify safe people. Children whose early years were not spent in a stable and safe home have trouble recognizing people likely to do them harm. That makes their world more unpredictable and scary. You can increase your child's felt safety by teaching the child to distinguish between friend and foe. One way to begin discussions about safety is by talking with your child about different animals and what nature gave each of them for safety. For example, the porcupine has quills, the cat has claws and the ability to hiss, and a tortoise can pull inside a shell. Then you can help your child identify what things help make him safe and how to determine whether a person is safe. We create a handout for children with the following information. There are many ways to know if people are safe. Here are some. Safe people will be kind to you. Safe people will care about you. Safe people will listen to you. Safe people will not hurt you. Safe people will not threaten you. Safe people will not tell you to keep a secret from your parents. Safe people will not touch you in ways that are scary or hurtful. Handle food issues gently. It's not unusual for adopted and foster children to hoard food. The deprivation they suffered early in life has hardwired their primitive brain to believe that starvation is just around the corner. Food becomes a great source of comfort to these children. Respect and treat these fears gently. One little girl we worked with, 4 years after she left the orphanage, showed her mother something startling. The child stood with her arms stuck straight out in front of her, and then she curled and uncurled her fingers repeatedly. "Do you know what this means?" she asked her mother, flexing two little empty hands at her. "No, sweetheart. What is that?" "This is, please, orphanage worker. Please stop and give me food." "But they don't stop," she said. That story should help give you insight into the plight some children endured before they came to you and why food remains a sensitive issue for them. One way you can make them more comfortable is to share control over the food. For example, you might let your child help you serve food for the family. If a little boy helps you cut the pie, he can feel more in control and learn that daddy is supposed to get a bigger piece because he's a grown-up. Sometimes children believe they get smaller portions because they are loved less, and in the orphanage that could easily have seemed true to a hungry child. Another way to increase felt safety is to make food easily available. You can put together a basket of healthy foods in small sealed packages, such as raisins or nuts, which the child can keep in her bedroom. This can be an immensely nurturing gesture to an adopted child who wakes up hungry and frightened. Finding the food waiting, she is immediately reassured. Help the child meet new challenges. Sometimes you might get strange requests from your adoptive child that at first blush look like they're motivated by your child's laziness or manipulation techniques. Instead, these requests are typically driven by terror. If parents can decipher the underlying message of fear, they'll be able to respond compassionately and kindly, with felt safety. Here's one example. A pretty girl, who spent the first 11 of her 12 years in an orphanage, phones her mother following an after-school event. "Mommy, can you come and drive me home from school?" "But Jenny, it's only 4 blocks away. You'll be okay." "But Mommy, I don't want to go alone." Instead of, "That's ridiculous, Jenny. Why should I come and get you with the car when it's such an easy walk? Plenty of other kids do it every day, and they're fine." Say, "Sweetheart, here's what I'll do. I'm going to walk beside you, and you can ride your bike next to me for the whole way home. I'll do that for a week or a month or a year, however long it takes until you feel safe. Then you can say to me, Mom, I'm ready to ride my bike alone. This second approach is much more effective because it offers felt safety and respects the girl's fear. Just because the parent knows the path home is safe, it doesn't mean that Jenny has encoded that same sense of security. And after all, why would she? During the years that other schoolchildren walked safely back and forth along this path each day, Jenny was living unprotected, in a situation where she was sexually abused on a regular, ongoing basis. For this little girl, menace remains around every corner. Fear of walking home alone is legitimate and appropriate to her life experiences. By walking with the child for as long as she needs, her mother helps Jenny learn that it is a safe activity, one which can even be enjoyable. The mother also builds trust and attunement by providing support as long as it is needed. Be approachable. For many adopted and foster kids, adults have been associated with pain and disappointments. So it makes sense that they pull away and tend to avoid people. We want to do everything we can to change that perception and make ourselves approachable and safe. One way to accomplish this is by getting down to their height level, either by crouching or kneeling, before speaking to them. Once there, use a non-threatening voice that is calm and modulated. Another strategy is to pair ourselves with things that the child enjoys and likes. So offer small toys and gum, for example, in a gesture of friendliness. Rather than sending the child off to play alone with the toy, join him or her in play or watch and compliment their efforts. When a child does begin to approach voluntarily and open up, reward that behavior. Respond with affection, interest, a warm voice, and smiling eyes. Never scolding. In a sense, establish a trust account that functions like a bank account. The more you demonstrate trustworthiness to a child and the more you can give the child felt safety, the higher your account gets. Occasionally, you will have to make a withdrawal on the account by asking your child to meet new challenges and master new and difficult tasks. Never withdraw more than 20% of that trust account. A positive balance on your trust account means you're promoting felt safety and obtaining a concrete biochemical benefit or reducing stress hormones in your child's body, which in turn promotes bonding and allows healthy development. Introduce the child to a new environment. You can help make a child's world predictable by explaining and orienting her to new physical surroundings. For example, when you visit someone else's home, ask the hostess permission to give your child a tour of the house so your little one knows how to find the bathroom, where the kitten stays, where the toys are kept, and so on. It's difficult to know in advance how long it will take to orient a child to a new environment. Depending on the complexity of the situation and the depth of your child's fear, this can be surprisingly time-consuming. Make sure your schedule is flexible so you can devote a sufficient amount of time. Here's an extreme, but real, example of what can be involved. An adoptive mom brought her son, 5-year-old Robbie, in for summer camp pre-testing. The testing area is in a university building that has an institutional feel. On the day Robbie walked down its wide halls past a steady stream of strangers, he could hear distant clanging where plumbers were fixing pipes on an upstairs floor. Walking the hallway toward the appointment, Robbie became increasingly panicked, perhaps fearing he was returning to an orphanage. By the time he met one of our team, Dr. Karen Purvis, his eyes were darting around and his little shoulders were stiff. Robbie's breathing was shallow, his pupils were dilated, and his hands were balled into tight fists. He was unable to focus enough to answer any test questions. "Robbie, do you need something?" asked Karen. Unable to articulate an answer, he shook his head. "Robbie, are you feeling afraid?" she asked more specifically. "Yes," he admitted. Karen delayed the actual testing and instead began orienting him to the new environment. She started by showing Robbie the key to the office where they were sitting and let him hold it. She invited him to practice helping her lock and unlock the door. Then she arranged for the 5-year-old and his mother to lock her out of the office. When Karen knocked, the boy would respond, "Who is it?" Once she answered, he would look at his mom's eyes and ask permission to unlock the door. If his mother said yes, he could unlock the door. The three of them acted this scene out a few times to help him feel some control and predictability in his environment. Then they took it a step further because the boy remained fearful. Karen held one of Robbie's hands and his mother took the other, and together they walked throughout the whole building, looking into people's offices and classrooms. On the elevator, Robbie was allowed to push the button to take them upstairs. On the third floor, they saw a workman hammering on pipes. This helped explain some of the frightening noises he was hearing. Discarded nuts and bolts lay on the ground. Karen asked the workman if the boy could have one of these cast-offs, and when the workman agreed, Robbie picked out one and put it in his pocket. The boy thought it was a treasure, and it became a tangible symbol of his mastery of the new place. After thanking the workman, the two adults and the little boy went back to the elevator, where Robbie was allowed to push the button, taking them back to the testing floor. Back in the testing room, they closed the door, and Robbie locked it behind them with his mother's permission. Karen led the boy through a few minutes of deep breathing exercises just to get him settled in. Then the testing proceeded, and Robbie did just fine. This interaction underscores the importance of felt safety, because although the boy's mother and Karen knew that the boy was perfectly safe in the university building, the child himself couldn't comprehend that until he had surveyed the place and become acclimated. Until he felt the safety for himself, the boy's ability to think clearly and handle more challenging tasks was compromised, immobilized by fear. Just as with animals, humans scan the environment to see if they're safe. It's a basic survival mechanism. Helping a child orient to a new environment lets a traumatized child set aside legitimate survival concerns. Only after that has been done can we ask for their full attention. Don't catastrophize. By painting the worst-case scenario, you will terrorize an already scared child. Instead, give the youngster only enough information so he can make smarter choices. Consider ways to get your message across to a child whose rash behavior worries you. For example, instead of, "If you run out in the street, you're going to get run over by a truck and killed, and you'll be dead, and I'll never see you again," say, "It is not safe for you in the street because there could be a car or a truck, and Mommy would be so sad if you got hurt." Instead of, "If you go out after dark, the boogeyman might come after you and do very, very bad things to you," say, "It is not safe for you to walk in the dark by yourself. Sometimes bad people hurt little girls who walk by themselves in the dark. Mommy would be so sad if you got hurt. It will be safer if we go together." Children do need to know consequences, but in a way that engenders greater awareness, not in a way that engenders deeper fear. Honor their emotions. Adopted and foster children often carry deep sadness inside them from their earlier losses, in addition to the ordinary feelings that come up in everyday life. A little girl may miss a friend she can't see anymore. Another may be angry that her biological parents went away, while a little boy may be scared of a big dog that looks just like another that once bit him. Parents need to make it safe for children to express feelings without encountering dismissiveness or ridicule. All emotions, including the messy ones like grief, frustration, and anger, are okay. Avoid shaming statements such as, "Big boys don't cry," or demeaning questions such as, "What are you crying about?" Those approaches are invalidating and disrespectful, and they make a child feel unsafe. Even if a child's emotions appear insignificant or funny, a healing parent shows respect and doesn't judge. After all, in a child's world, a lost toy truck is as upsetting as a fender bender would be to you. Parents need to show children through their body language, words, and actions that it is normal to have feelings. Accepting feelings doesn't mean that you automatically accept inappropriate expressions of those feelings, such as tantrums. So we tell a child, "It's okay to be angry that Johnny stole your baseball, but it's not okay to use your fists and hurt him. Then we explain how to respond. You can say, "Johnny, I'm angry that you took my baseball. Please give it back." Always honor and acknowledge feelings, and then, if necessary, show youngsters more appropriate ways to express themselves. One way parents can respond, or teach siblings to respond to each other, in a fair and balanced way, using words, is with this formula. When you, insert action here, I feel, insert emotion here, and what I need is, insert what is needed to bring resolution. Keep in mind that if you are uncomfortable with emotions yourself, it will be tough for you to give your child license to express his or her own feelings. You might instinctively censor the child's emotions in order to limit your own discomfort. Some parents encourage expressions of joy, but feel compelled to shut down such emotions as sadness and anger. Try to recognize and overcome that tendency, because there is great healing power in safe self-expression. Respect their own life story. Adopted and foster children are on a unique journey through life. No one knows an individual child's personal history in the same way that he or she does. After all, that child lived it. Parents need to respect and accept the stories that these children bring with them. It can be tempting to try to recast an adopted child's history. A parent might want to paint a pretty picture of the adoption by whitewashing the past, saying something like, "Your mommy loved you so very much, and she wept and wept to give you up, but she knew she couldn't give you the best." It can also be tempting to speak badly of a child's birth parent in order to make his or her new home look better by contrast, saying something like, "Your mother was a 16-year-old drug addict and didn't want you." Fight the urge to tell your child's story using your own value judgments or interpretations of the past. A healing parent's job is to simply give neutral information so a child can work out the past for himself or herself. In the last example, it would be best to tell your son or daughter something along the lines of, "I do not know very much about your mother. I know she was very young, and she may have used drugs, and she may have lived on the street, but I don't know how she felt when she was pregnant with you. What do you think she felt?" This approach opens a window through which your child can begin to look at and share his life story. Accept and honor what the child tells you and the emotions he shares about it. Let your child be the authority on his own life. Feelings of safety take time. Despite their scars of past deprivation and lingering fearfulness, at-risk children can learn to take comfort and safety from their families. Be patient, and do everything in your power to let your children understand that they are safe and welcome in their new homes. Deeply encoded fear responses take time to ease, but eventually, as your child heals and grows, situations and circumstances that were once scary and threatening become less so. Eventually, you won't need to be as vigilant with his or her environment. Healing can't be rushed, but you can help it progress dramatically by giving your child the gift of felt safety. Chapter 5. Teaching Life Values. "I hate you! I hate you! You're a bad mother!" yelled the little boy. "Hold it," said his mother firmly, holding her hand up in a stop gesture. "Marco, it is not okay for you to talk to me with those kinds of words." She knelt down to his level and took his hand gently. "Tell me what you need, and tell me with respect," said his mother. The boy looked down and away, his face red. His mom searched his face, trying to make eye contact. "Marco, let me see those eyes." She touched just under his chin with a gentle hand, light as a feather, and coaxed, "Let me see those eyes." The boy glanced at her hesitantly. "I love to see those eyes," praised his mom. "Sweetheart, you can say anything you need to say to me. If you think that I'm being mean, you can say that. If you feel angry at me, you can say that too. Just say it with respect. Now tell me what you need." "I don't want to go to bed yet," admitted Marco. Children who began life without a devoted caregiver learned one simple value: survival. These youngsters dealt with difficult circumstances on sheer instinct alone, perhaps by becoming physically dominant or covertly manipulative or intentionally avoidant. They never learned appropriate social interactions or gained confidence in themselves and others. When they arrive in a home with a family that cares about them, these children face a new world with dramatically shifted expectations and priorities. That's a challenging adjustment. One of the tasks adoptive and foster parents face is to coach their children in appropriate life values. The best way to teach values to children who have attention problems and language deficits is by using simple and brief language. Keep your message short and sweet. We suggest a group of stock phrases or scripts that are designed to communicate life values simply. They should be used and reviewed regularly with your child. In the opening scene above, Marco's mother uses the script, "Show Respect," along with an eye contact script to focus her son on appropriate life values. During their interactions, she catches him doing things well and praises him. She reinforces the words with simple hand gestures. She uses these standardized interactions to help guide, correct, and praise Marco. Perhaps the most important lesson you want your child to learn is that he can always say what he feels, and he can always ask for his needs and wants. But it all must be said appropriately and respectfully. As your child becomes more and more successful in verbal communication, his social skills will grow, and he will find it less necessary to act out with his behavior. You can use the following scripts to guide your child toward improved verbal communication as well as appropriate life values. Respect. Your child needs to use respectful words and actions, plus show respectful body language, such as gentle eye contact, appropriate facial expressions, and appropriate voice. In our work with children, we have zero tolerance for disrespect of any kind, whether it is disrespect of possessions, feelings, property, body, or body space. We teach children to treat themselves and other people with respect. This respect includes not touching things, property, or people without permission. If a five-year-old throws his playmate's toy instead of handing it to him, his mother can say, "Whoa, we treat toys with respect. Let's have a redo, and this time you show respect for Johnny and his toy." Then she gives the child a chance to practice the right way of doing it himself. Once he hands the toy over gently, she praises him by saying, "Good showing respect." When a little girl purposely bangs into another child, we can ask, "Was that treating Malin with respect?" and prompt for a no answer. Then we follow up by saying, "Let's practice showing respect when we walk by Malin." We walk the child through the appropriate behavior. When she does it right, we compliment her by saying, "Good showing respect," and giving a high-five salute. Since children learn from watching how adults handle situations, they need to see us treating people and things with respect. The burden is on parents to walk the talk. Even at times when parents need to be firm, they can still be respectful to whomever they're dealing with, especially their own children. Using words. At-risk kids often rely on tantrums, running away, or aggression to express their sadness, fears, or frustration. They use behavior to communicate what they can't express verbally. Although you seek to understand their behavior, you still need to wean them off acting out by constantly encouraging them to use words. With practice and encouragement, your child will be able to use language to communicate appropriately. Prompt him or her regularly with the phrase, "Use your words." For example, when your little boy pounds his fist on the bed and scowls, you can ask him what he needs and what he is feeling. You can say, "Use your words and tell Mommy what you need." If your child is still stuck, ask more questions that require a yes or no answer. For example, ask, "Are you angry?" A chart that illustrates feelings can also provide a visual reference and communication tool. Once your boy nods his head, you can gently ask, "What are you angry about? Use your words and tell me." When he succeeds, applaud and say, "Wahoo! Great using your words!" A child who is emotionally shut down may need to take baby steps toward using words. This might include drawing his feeling, telling where in his body he feels it, or even selecting a color that expresses his feelings. As your child starts using words to express himself, it becomes easier for you to meet his needs. When your child sees that you are responsive to his concerns, his trust grows, and wonderful progress can be made. Parents should use words too, but few of them. To save time, your impulse may be to race over and grab little hands away from objects that are off limits. But you need to curb that instinct. You need to use words instead of actions to redirect your child, unless there is urgent physical danger. Instead of swooping down to pick up your small child and physically moving her away from mischief, stop her with your words. Use short, simple phrases and direct her to make good choices. Verbally address your child's intention. Speak firmly. If she does something that has to be undone, for example, by returning a toy to the shelf where it belongs, ask your child to put it back herself and wait patiently until she complies. We explain this approach in greater detail in Chapter 6. Remember that because of your child's potential language processing limitations, you'll have better success when you keep instructions brief. By using words to direct your child, you'll provide a great role model. Plus, by making your child face the consequences of her own impulses, she will begin to learn to self-regulate, another important skill. Gentleness and kindness. Many at-risk adopted children don't understand how to modulate their own behaviors. They cannot distinguish between a shout or a whisper, a rough touch or a soft touch, a mean facial expression or a soft facial expression. Coaching and showing a child how to be kind and gentle help overcome these issues. This script begins by heightening the child's self-awareness so he or she can self-regulate better. It also guides the child to have empathy and respect for other creatures. One way to practice this script is by letting your child handle a puppy. Before the child is permitted to touch or hold the animal, a parent demonstrates how it's done. Show how to pet with the grain of the fur, touching gently but firmly, and how to cradle the puppy. "We need to be kind and gentle with animals," says the parent. "See how I use a kind and gentle touch." This can be demonstrated by the parents stroking the child's arm gently. Now you try being kind and gentle. When the child tries, his or her effort should be praised. When ready, the child can touch the puppy with supervision. As he or she does it correctly, the parent says, "Great, being kind and gentle with the puppy." Consequences. Children need to be introduced to the concept of consequences as part of learning to make good choices. This can be done simply and within the context of teaching other life values. For example, you can talk to your child about the negative consequences of treating a puppy harshly. Prompt your little one to brainstorm with you. Some of the consequences would be, it won't like you, it won't come to you, it will run away from you, and it might bite you. Or you might discuss the positive consequences of treating a kitten with respect and gentleness. The kitten will purr, it will like you, and it will trust you, are some possibilities, for example. Making eye contact. An excellent way to connect with your child is through eye contact. Getting children in the habit of looking us in the eye increases their focus, learning, and interpersonal connection. At-risk children tend to resist eye contact for a variety of reasons. Sensory defensiveness. Deep depression, cultural taboos or previous traumas that still induce fear. Don't rush a fearful child toward this goal, but with practice, you can help overcome his or her fears. Here are some simple ways to encourage eye contact. Move your head into the child's field of vision. Briefly stop speaking. The pause will pique his curiosity or concern, and he will typically look up at you. Say something, using his name in the context of a sentence. Ask for eye contact directly with such phrases as, "Let me see those lovely eyes," or, "Let's see those beautiful green eyes." If he physically moves away, playfully move back into his field of vision. Listening and obeying. Parents are the authority in a family, and children are expected to respond to their instructions. You should not have to scream or yell to gain your child's cooperation. Instead, you should calmly remind her to listen and obey. Once your child cooperates, praise her and remind her of what she did well. Say, "Good listening and obeying." You can help your child practice obedience at calm times by playing games such as Simon Says. In this game, any instruction that starts with the phrase, "Simon Says," is followed, and all other instructions are ignored. The game can be varied to have the child mimic behavior, such as, "Simon says, take a giant step back," or, "Simon says, clap your hands." Speak, such as, "Simon says, count to five," or even do facial expressions, such as, "Simon says, copy mommy's funny expression." Give your child a turn at giving the commands. Another way to playfully reinforce this message is with a game called Stop and Go. Your child runs, walks around, or rides a tricycle or bike until you shout, "Stop!" At that sound, your child must quit moving and remain frozen until you say, "Go!" This game teaches your little boy or girl to respond to a vocal command even when in a physical frenzy. Praise your child for responding quickly. Authority, or who's the boss? The more unpredictable and out of control your child's world was during his first months or years of life, the more controlling his behavior typically is as he gets older. So we often see children from impoverished backgrounds trying to take charge of their families. When a child starts getting bossy or tries to take control of a situation, it's time to remind him of his role. You don't have to get into a big negotiation or discussion. Just say, "Adults are in charge." Alternatively, you can ask, "Who's the boss here? Are you the boss?" Once your child acknowledges that he isn't in charge, you can say, "That's right. Parents are the boss. It's not your job to tell the other children what to do." Deep down, understanding that a parent is in charge can be of great comfort to formerly neglected or abused children, who themselves had to be self-reliant too young because their first caretakers were not up to the job. With permission and supervision. Obviously, a child must not run out into the street unattended or use kitchen equipment unsupervised or take it upon herself to do any number of other activities inappropriate for a youngster. To reinforce the concept that your child needs to turn to safe adults for guidance, use the phrase, "with permission and supervision." For example, you might allow your little girl to help you make a milkshake and allow her to participate. You could guide her with instructions. "Wait until I turn off the machine here. Then, when I say, 'Ready,' touch this green button and count to 10 while the blender mixes your milkshake. After 10, touch this red button and turn it off." Then you could count to 10 with her and prompt her to follow directions. Accepting no. Although we try to meet a child's needs consistently and say yes to many of his needs, sometimes we must disappoint a child. For many children, hearing the word no sends them into spasms of misbehavior. A great way to interrupt that downward spiral before it becomes a meltdown is to quickly, before he even has a chance to throw a tantrum, compliment the child. "Wow, what a great job of accepting no!" Use this technique sparingly because it is challenging and makes a child really stretch. Accepting no will be easier for your child to tolerate if the majority of the time he receives genuine positive feedback from you. It's best to use corrective approaches like accepting no infrequently and only after your trust account with the child has a high balance. We explore this strategy further in Chapter 6. Requesting whole sentences. Your goal is to teach your child communication skills that everybody understands. So as your child becomes more proficient at using words, you can up the ante by requesting full sentences. Whenever it seems appropriate, you can encourage him or her by saying, "Give me a whole sentence, sweetie." For example, when your little girl comes home from school and says, "Snack," you might clarify by saying, "Do you want a snack?" "Yeah," replies the child. Can you ask me using a whole sentence? Can I have a snack? Great using a whole sentence. Yes, you can have a snack. You may have a choice. You can have a banana with peanut butter or a granola bar. Which do you choose? Offering choices. Children feel empowered and more in control of their environments when they have choices. It's a good idea to limit their choices to two or three specific options so their reasoning and decision-making capabilities aren't overtaxed. These modest choices allow children to exercise appropriate levels of control even while you remain ultimately in charge. For example, your 6-year-old boy might refuse to put away his toys before bed. You can hold up a hand near the child's face and put up fingers to signify the two choices. You explain, holding up just one finger now. You may put away your toys first and then take a bath, or, holding up two fingers now, you may take a bath first and then put away your toys. Which do you choose? Focus and complete your task. Early deprivation and abuse can make a child anxious and leave attention deficits that make it difficult for him to concentrate. As a child feels increasingly safe, see Chapter 4, he'll be better equipped to pay attention. You can also help your child pay attention by using gentle reminders to redirect his focus onto an assigned task. For example, if instead of putting his shoes on as you asked earlier, you find little Harry playing on the floor with his toys, you can calmly say, "Harry, what was your task, son?" If he is unable to recall, you may have to prompt by saying, "You need to put on your shoes." Pause. "Harry, focus and complete your task." You may need to patiently repeat, "Focus and complete your task," a few times before the task gets finished. A goal of this direction is to help children internalize the ability to stay on task. More life values from TheraPlay. We particularly like three life values promoted by the TheraPlay Institute, a Chicago-based international not-for-profit organization. This group trains mental health professionals in an interactive and nurturing method designed to help at-risk youngsters. Cornerstones of their approach for groups are captured in the phrases, "No hurts," "Stick together," and "Have fun." No hurts. This short phrase is easy, even for small children, to understand and echoes other life values, such as showing respect and being kind and gentle. For example, if a little girl yanks her sister's hair, you can physically intercept her and say firmly, "No hurts." This phrase refers equally to no hurts on the inside by saying mean and insulting things, and no hurts on the outside by hitting or injuring things or people. This is an especially important lesson for children with a history of harm. Stick together. The concept of working together as a team or a family will be unfamiliar to many children who grew up feeling that they had to fend for themselves in a forbidding world. Verbalizing and demonstrating that families stick together is an important reminder of connectedness and helps counteract alienation. This phrase can also be used to combat indiscriminate friendliness. If your small child has made her way across the playground and now has her hand on a stranger's leg, you'd quickly approach the child, perhaps put your arm around her, and gently say, "Stick with Mommy." Later, you could do stranger practice together, as explained in Chapter 9. Have fun. There's no better way to cement learning or the lesson of joyous family relationships than by sharing a good time. In Chapter 8, we'll explain a similar strategy, which we call playful engagement. Essentially, it involves creating situations that allow you and your child to interact playfully and productively. Fun is the sweetness of building a relationship. We try to stress with children that you first need the values of no hurts and to stick together in order to have fun. You can't have the third value, fun, without those first two. Values for parents. The scripts explained in this chapter offer a standard vocabulary for guiding at-risk children. They're a kind of shorthand for conveying important life lessons. As parents, you can't just recite these phrases. You have to model and embody them for your child, consistently. A strong role model makes the best teacher. Be a rock-steady leader. You can be strong and decisive, and yet still allow your child to have some control over his or her life, such as having the opportunity to choose between options you have selected. Remember that when a child starts acting wild, it's a symptom of the child's own history, including inner neurochemistry and neurological impairments. At-risk children are simply trying to get their needs met and don't yet understand the proper way to do that. They need a great deal of guided practice to succeed. By remaining calm and in control of yourself, you'll be in the best position to handle upsets effectively and guide your child toward better behavior. By controlling ourselves and letting the child practice appropriate, supervised control, the child ultimately becomes empowered to use self-control. Listen actively and reinforce connections. Demonstrate that your child's thoughts and feelings are important by looking in his or her eyes and paying attention when your child speaks. Attentive, active listening helps a child feel secure and models appropriate behavior. It demonstrates how your child should listen and look at you when you speak. It can be helpful to take your child's hand gently and/or kneel down to eye level while you speak. Make steady eye contact to show your availability and receptiveness. Give as much support as